He was a blue-eyed, blonde-haired white man who somehow always felt and identified with total outside margins of mainstream society.
Playing Nirvana.
The Cobain 50.
Nirvana.
Kurt Cobain's top 50 albums.
Nirvana.
From listener-powered KEXP.
This is the Cobain 50 from listener-powered KEXP. I'm Martin Douglas.
And I'm Dusty Henry, welcoming you to our second roundtable in this series, The Radical Politics of Kurt Cobain.
So once a month, we attempt to group some of these albums together from Kurt's famous list around certain themes and core ideas. And this month, we are focused, as Dusty said, on the radical politics of artists like The Clash, Bad Brains, MDC, Public Enemy, and of course, the reason why we're all here, Nirvana.
And today we're really stoked because we have two of our good friends and colleagues, Albina Cabrera, host of El Cancionero de Kurt and El Sonido on KXP.
Hola, amigos. Thanks for having me again. Ready for this second round?
And our boss and host of 50 Years of Hip Hop on KEXP, host of the afternoon show, Larry Mizell Jr.
It's the boss. That was up. Hey, it's good to be here, y'all.
All of these albums that we're talking about today and that we've covered over the last month were from the 1980s, which spans from the Reagan era and the Thatcher era, two of the most notorious political regimes of pretty much our lifetimes. Larry, how do you think that this time period impacted or changed punk music?
I think that this time period and the politics of it helped define it, helped define the shape of it. You can't separate punk of these beginning stages of the 70s and 80s without thinking about political figures like Margaret Thatcher, like Ronald Reagan. They figured into people's band names, into song titles, into the topics of songs nonstop. It was a constant commentary on what was going on in the political sphere. So right from the outset, punk was pretty dedicated to being a commentator and a critic of what was going on in the world.
Yeah. Shout out to the band Reagan Youth.
Yeah.
Albina, how about you? What's up?
Margaret Thatcher. No, the Latin American context was impacted directly for the Reagan administration and for the Margaret Thatcher administration, because not only was the main reason of the contracultura in the U.S. and also in Europe, but we have to say that in Latin America, also the Latin American punk, the hardcore punk started because of that. In Argentina, we had a Malvinas War, that was basically one of the main reasons why all the youth in Latin America started to play punk, because the rock in English was banned in my home country. So, of course, if you're telling a teenager in South America or in Latin America, hey, you can't listen to these bands, is exactly what they are going to do. So during the 80s, I think that we could see like a more solid scene, because the proto-punk, you know, was already an old news, you know, in the late 70s. But we have to say that the 80s was the most solid era for punk and punk rock in Latin America, if we are talking about the legends, right? And of course, the impact in the society, the impact in the youth and in the socio-political context across the Americas, I have to say.
Yeah, it's such a pivotal time where punk kind of came into its own in the 80s. And it's such a contrast to the politics of the time that were very conservative, very like morning in America. It's like clean cut. Punk is like the yin and yang, like punk and these conservative like politics. And I feel like it was the right time for it to exist. It was really like, you know, the Ramones and Sex Pistols and stuff were great, but this really like harnessed the power of punk to be that like antagonist, to really like speak out against so brashly and loudly, as opposed to like, you know, this white picket fence American dream that was, or British dream that was being promoted at the time.
We can't forget about Public Enemy in this. Like, I feel as though hip hop's growth is a good analog, a good parallel for punk rock's growth. as punk was growing in the 1980s, as it was expanding into a social justice movement, so was hip hop. And thankfully, we've got that represented with Public Enemy.
Definitely. And, you know, it's the only hip hop entry on Kurt's list is Public Enemy's 1988 masterpiece. It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. It would almost be surprising that there would be a hip hop song or album at all on this list, I think, unless you know who Kurt is. And we all kind of do, because he talked about what his beliefs more than most people who front rock bands. And that's saying a lot. So his kind of stance on the misogyny and racism and homophobia that he saw in society and that he grew up around in Aberdeen was so present in this thing. So it made a lot of sense that he was listening to hip hop. And it made sense, too, that it was kind of a complicated relationship that he had with it, too. At least he said that. He said, you know, I can't listen to a lot of it. It's, you know, it's really misogynist. But he understood the importance of this very original music. He would talk about that. He said, African-Americans, of course, are bringing this totally original music. It's the first original music to come along since punk rock. And he understood that it was important that these people had a voice, and he just valued it. And he understood the context of the music that he made coming from African-American music, and would speak to that in a way that lots of people fronting bands weren't doing at the time, at least that I heard about. And it's perfect, too, that it's Public Enemy, it being one of the most like politically conscious, staunch, line in the sand. We're Public Enemy, you know what I mean? We're against American mainstream society as much as that record kind of says. Yeah, number 43 on the list.
I want to add that also it's interesting to see that these four bands and also albums were the more like radical ones that we have to say about this list. And when a Public Enemy has a huge story with the Chicano rap scene, yeah, right? And what was happening in the border between the U.S. and Mexico. Mm-hmm. So they were the main influence for all the Mexican rap scene, if we have to be more specific. And the Clash of Bad Brains on MDC were also like the common factor there. If we mention the relationship with Kurt Cobain and Nirvana, is how the youth were feeling. When you started the adult life, you were starting to see how the world works. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly that moment when you can find punk or hardcore as your, I don't know, home. And it's exactly what were happening in Latin America, specifically if we're talking about the U.S. role in the dictatorships in Latin America and the Margaret Thatcher role in international politics. Mm. And seeing someone like Joe Strummer, or seeing someone like, when in different moment, like Kurt Cobain, you know, speaking about what is happening in your home countries, were like a kind of inspiration. And of course that they were, I think that the key reasons why the young people in Latin America start playing punk and hardcore, I think.
That's a great point, Albina. And I think, you know, like MDC and Bad Brains, they came from this hardcore movement, which was like the evolution from like that Clash era. Also want to give a shout out to the DC punk scene and Bad Brains, which Martin, you talked about in your episode. Like all these things you're talking about, Albina, make sense to me, that this hardcore is happening on both coasts, but that East Coast DC scene was just like right in the heart of like the American capital while all this shit is happening. Like, that's just pure poetry, and it just makes so much sense.
I feel as though, yeah, we're talking about how Kurt galvanized a bunch of young Latin American people by talking about what's happening in their home countries. And I think the DC scene is crucial because this is literally their backyard that all of these global decisions are being made, and all of this catastrophe of community happening all over the world. So I think the core basis of the hardcore punk movement is to call out what's happening in your backyard.
And insist that, like, because it's happening in your backyard, you can affect what's happening in the world. It's an empowering kind of thing. You know what I mean? Not like a hopeless thing. Like there's this machine crushing you. It's happening right there, man. Go get out there. You know, that's a beautiful thing about punk.
It's interesting that we were talking about albums that were released in the 80s when the right wing was conquering the world.
Yeah.
And we are in 2024. And it's exactly what is happening right now.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe we are opening a new chapter of punk and hardcore. Hopefully.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, I feel as though the pendulum swings every couple decades and we're back in this really depressing conservative movement. All we can do is call it out and try to gather together as a community and fight it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what at least for me, when I growing up, that's what the punk and hardcore scene was for me. It was community and like, I grew up in Aberdeen. I grew up in Bremerton, Washington, which is fairly conservative Navy town. And, you know, if you have these ideologies that maybe, say, swing more left, it can be really pretty isolating. And when you find, like, I found, like, it was Screamo at the time. But you find that a group of people, like, oh, this is literally underground in a basement. And it's, people are saying stuff that I believe in. That's so powerful. And then you find out it's more than just your backyard. It's everyone else's backyards.
Yeah, Dusty, as you were talking about, you know, Kurt growing up in Aberdeen and hearing things like Public Enemy, I feel as though Public Enemy specifically captured the minds of a lot of the Olympia scene. Like, I think a lot of these albums I'm seeing on Kurt's list, knowing what I know through books and through his journals, like he found in his time in Olympia, and I know for a fact through interviewing certain artists that Public Enemy specifically was a big thing with college students at Evergreen and down in Oregon and, you know, even further afield all over the place, because they were tapping into something significant and that should be talked about widely, which was all of the things affecting Black people in the 1980s.
Absolutely. I mean, you have this kind of understanding of the blight and the horror of the crack epidemic, Night of the Living Bassheads. I mean, I remember seeing that video and I was just like, oh, like it contextualized the community I lived in a way that made it make more sense to me. And I lived there and people in the throes of addiction and the community falling into the kind of disrepair it did because of that so quickly in scant years, it went from like this kind of B-boy hip hop graffiti and breakdancing and people into that. And then it's like gangster shit and drug dealing, heavy, heavy, heavy. And that just, it was like night and day so quick. But I remember that video contextualized it in a way, in this kind of like, you know, and I'm not into that whole kind of trope of characterizing people addicted to opiates and whatnot as like zombies. But it had that this Night of the Living Dead kind of thing. It properly portrayed it as a horror, as a horrifying thing. And so they did that really well. They talked about the state of things. Chuck D had a quote kind of talking about the beginnings of Public Enemy, saying that, you know, the beginnings of Public Enemy, that it was a time of heightened right-wing politics, so the climate directed the direction of the group. The Berlin Wall was up. Nelson Mandela was in prison. Margaret Thatcher was running the UK. Reagan was out of control in the White House, and Bush Sr. was vice president and soon to be president. You can say we were up against it. So it was just this snapshot of everything going on in that record. And plus, sonically, it's just a punishing, dissonant thing that's got to appeal to people who appreciate like edgy guitar music. It's just it's itching that spot. So I'm sure that Kurt, among many others in the Oli scene and abroad, tapped into that really rock and roll aesthetic that was in the Bomb Squad production for Public Enemy.
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely chaotic.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a lot of the sound of New York and the feel and the the bodies and the cars everywhere and the honking horns.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's sensory overload.
Right.
I think musically, Public Enemy speaks to that. The Bomb Squad in particular in their production. When you talk about the crack cocaine epidemic, Larry, like, I not only lived through it, I lived in it.
Yeah.
Like, I was in a community where crack had ravaged the landscape.
Yeah.
And this so-called war on drugs that Reagan helped continue, there's some debate about the United States involvement on it. And allegedly, in scare quotes, the CIA helped fund the Nicaraguan Civil War, right, with funds supplied by the crack cocaine trade, eradicating impoverished and mostly black neighborhoods.
Yeah.
I also want to add that this war on drugs moment started to build a narrative around Mexico and Colombia, you know, as a part of this kind of enemies that we have to fight.
Yeah, this was the first time I was hearing about Colombia and Nicaragua and stuff like that. But it would be from these, like, sweaty white dudes on the news and Senate and congressional hearings saying that, of course, we, you know, had nothing to do with this over here, this over there. And we don't trade weapons for hostages or anything like that. And I was just like trying to understand who the people were behind these names and these stories. And I knew that the guys I was looking at, these weren't my friends. You know what I mean? And this war on drugs, it felt like a war on the people.
Exactly.
And the drugs that were a part of it felt like part of that same side. So I don't know who was really doing the fighting and resisting and, you know, who the war was really on, but it seemed extremely one-sided, like so many wars seem to. Yeah.
Yes, and that was the umbrella that justified a lot of oppression and a lot of violence against our communities. And when you were saying about Nicaragua and the role of the CIA, we have to say that the role of the CIA across Latin America and during the dictatorships there is how they build the narrative about their allies in Latin America, about how we act in Latin America, the role in Argentina, about being the most white country in Latin America. Mm. And that was part of the CIA, you know, archives and wars, dictatorships, and of course, like, a lot of work under the Reagan administration was part of the darkest moment in the continent, I have to say, yes.
And it seemed like a lot of these dynamics, young folks in the United States were becoming aware of because of punk rock.
Absolutely.
Because of the Minutemen, because of the Clash, you know what I mean? They were really engaging with this idea. And it's just a foundational part of so many people's politics for that reason.
See, and specifically punk rock, or, you know, if we are talking about the Clash and Joe Strummer, yes, of course, the Clash is mainstream. Everyone knows the Clash. But also having, like, Joe Strummer being from London and being a person who was interested in Latin music, interested in reggae, in ska, in the music from Jamaica, in the music from Latin America, in the music from Andrés Landero, it was a huge thing for us. You know, it was a huge thing to see, oh, this person from London is talking about us and also is interested about us, which is something that impacts a lot in our cultures, of course, that are all the time trying to be oppressed. So if we have to talk specifically about the Clash on Joe Strummer, well, no, that is a huge story there. And I think that it started when Jamaica became an independent country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's stay on that. Let's talk about the Clash and Thatcherism and how British nationalism affected Jamaica when it was becoming its own country and kind of the rise of reggae and ska in the UK. Like, yeah, let's speak on that.
Bueno, when Jamaica became an independent country in 1962, but before that, there were a huge migration In the 50s from Jamaica to Europe, specifically London. And it's the main reason why we started to see punks with ska fans together. And of course, we know now about ska punk, but it's interesting. The ska punk was huge in Argentina, in Mexico. We have like huge legends there. For example, Todos Tus Muertos in Argentina, with a huge influence of Bad Brains, but also in Mexico. It's interesting to see how Joe Strummer started to absorb all these Jamaican rhythms and started to incorporate those in the Clash music and also in their own music taste.
Most definitely. Got to shout out Don Letts, who's kind of the Clash's filmmaker, videographer, aide-de-camp, and played a huge role in kind of bringing those Jamaican sounds to a lot of the London punks at the time through his DJing at the, I want to say it was the Roxy.
Yeah, the Roxy.
Yeah.
I don't think there's more than five people in the world right now cooler than Don Letts. So, yeah, we'll get into that for sure.
Yeah, and there's, you know, just on the reggae point too, that I think, you know, we're talking a lot about reggae, punk, and hip hop that maybe seem on their face dissimilar, but really not. And especially like in that London reggae scene. Have you ever seen the movie Babylon?
No.
Oh, it's a great movie from the 80s, but it's kind of documenting the underground reggae and ska scene and like literal basement shows with the big sound systems. And really, it's the same aesthetic between ideology between these three genres or cultures to me is DIY, like do it yourself. And like, you know, the Clash and Ramones, Sex Pistols, they were on like major labels. And then you got bands like MDC and Bad Brains doing it on their own because like what company in the right mind is going to put money behind politics that are like so far out from the mainstream at that time.
They're already taking a beating for supporting that first wave of bands anyway.
Right. Yeah. That was too much.
Like, right.
We'll sign MDC next.
Yeah. I think hip hop had a lot of that same stuff too, where, you know, kind of post the furor around Ice-T's metal band Body Count and then their song Cop Killer, where it made it really hard for hip hop to get signed, even though that was a heavy metal band. It was fronted by a guy who also rapped. So, yeah, the industry ebbs and flows like that with fear.
Yeah. Also, I think these major labels, these huge corporations are afraid of platforming artists from the margins when they don't portray the message that these companies want them to portray, which is indicative of the rise of capitalism in hip hop and when rap artists really started making money.
Right. And, you know, if there's people listening to this and they're like, what's this got to do with Nirvana? this is the stuff that fueled Kurt's worldview, that had so much to do with the music that changed everything, i.e. Nirvana. Like, it's inseparable. Even if I feel like Kurt kind of spoke to his politics a lot more off of the mic than on it. That is not as much in the music. It was a little bit more poetic. You kind of got a sense in a way like, oh, he's talking about like sexual assault. Oh, he's talking about like machismo and you know, gun ownership and stuff like that. So you're kind of getting clues into who he is. But, you know, when he was being interviewed, he would just say all of this stuff. I don't fuck with this and this and this. All of these conversations, this is the stuff that Kurt is cut from, in case anybody is wondering.
We are the albums that we listen to. So
that's right.
This is basically how we build our point of view and the vision of the world. And it's interesting what you were saying about being explicit, you know, an explicit activist through your songs. I think that when you are coming from countries or contexts or communities that were oppressed, you as an artist, you're starting to build more creative ways to talk about that. So we can see more creativity or more analogias in the lyrics, you know, to speak about, you know, racism or to speak about poverty or et cetera. So it's interesting also to see how the lyrics change, you know, depending the context.
For sure.
Yeah, what you were saying, Albina, about the records make us, I mean, think about this time in like Kurt's life, like he would have been in the 80s, like a teenager going into his 20s. Like that's one of the most pivotal times in your life. Right. Generally, there's some study about like the music you listen to in your teenagers, the music is going to like stick with you like forever. Like I can listen to Nirvana is a good example for me. Like mm-hmm. I listened as a teenager. It's with me forever. Like it's inseparable. Even I love music now, new bands, but like you can't really top that first love in a lot of ways. And it's interesting to look at this list and these records in particular and think like, this is his core. Like,
right.
This is like Public Enemy, NDC, Bad Brains, The Clash. Like that's, you can understand how that would, how the type of music he would make or like what he would say in person, if that's where you're coming from.
Yeah. I think as Dusty was saying, it influenced Kurt as a person. And as we're talking about how he decried homophobia, sexism, sexual assault, racism, everything that these conservative movements like the Reagan era or Thatcherism embodied, I think was, you know, obviously in him from a very young age as he's yeah. growing into adulthood. And I think that's what makes this list so significant, is that it not only fueled his musical taste, these albums fueled his worldview.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention one of the worst Nirvana shows that took place in Buenos Aires. It was the only time that, the only moment that Nirvana played there. And they were touring with the Calamity Jane
yes.
band.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad that you're getting into this.
Of course. This is a crazy story, a very sad story, but I love what Kurt Cobain decided to do, that basically was to do the worst show of Nirvana because the Argentine crowd deserved it. Basically, when Calamity Jane went to the stage, the super machista crowd started to insult them, and it was a very horrible moment. And Kurt Cobain was super mad at that. So basically, during the show, it was really bad show. He changed the lyrics and they were playing like very bad, and they never came back to Argentina. Wow. And he was very, very mad about the machista culture mm-hmm. in Argentina. At that time, it was like huge. Well, it's still huge, but it's different now. So for the Argentine feminist movement, like Kurt Cobain is a kind of hero, you know, because what he did supporting the Calamity Janes in that show in Argentina.
That's amazing, you know, because instead of coming out and like lecturing and haranguing people, he's, you know, he's such like a trickster, you know, mischievous guy. He's just like, I'm going to just mess this up in every way possible so you don't get your money's worth of your one Nirvana show that you're going to get because you were so rude to these openers that we brought with us. How dare you? That's amazing. I just love that about Kurt. I feel like there was a point where he was an innocent little boy, and at some point he was like, I'm an outsider. I don't know what period of life he would have ever identified. He was a blue-eyed, blonde-haired white man who somehow always felt and identified with total outside margins of mainstream society. I always appreciated that. He always seemed like a stand-up dude. And I want to say his beliefs influence just the paradigm of how we talk about the world so much now in ways that don't always get talked about. Like he was just out front in an early, early time, 30 years ago now. It's crazy to think about.
And it would have been, you know, looking at the context of that time too, in rock music, you know, machismo was like,
it was it.
That was it. That was what rock music was. Like all the heavy metal. It would have been like really easy for Kurt to just cash in and like play the role of the rock star and not say anything about anything and just go out there and play your songs, you know, like, but he took it upon himself to speak to these issues, which I think wasn't precedented for like an act on like David Geffen or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. He would be on the margins today if he was as outspoken as he was about these issues. So to think 30 years ago, 35 years ago, he was speaking out on these situations, on these just horrific things that were normalized. It's profound how much on the margins that he would have been, or that he was back then. It's, I say would have been because I can't even imagine how far on the margins he was for his political views, for his social justice views back then. Like, I feel like we still get shit for, you know, yeah, speaking up about this shit today.
Absolutely. And he just, he took every opportunity. And the bigger the platform, the more he's going to spike the ball. Yeah, if I'm on the cover of Rolling Stone, I'm going to tell you, corporate magazines still suck. If I'm playing Saturday Night Live and they want us to do this song, we're going to do Rape Me instead. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, he's always going to take it there. I think if Kurt was alive now, he would be... he would be a real terror to so-called liberal mainstream society these days. It's why he inspires so much of us to this day.
Oh, yeah. Inspired me personally. Like, I feel like, I mean, it's safe to say everybody in this room knows I've gotten my hand slapped a couple times while working here. And that is from the direct influence of Kurt Cobain and his desire, his calling to empathize, to put himself with people on the margins.
Yeah.
Yes, it's an interesting futurismo what you were saying about Kurt Cobain, because I've been talking with different writers and historians in Latin America about the current scene of punk and hardcore punk. And many of the legends, you know, of those bands in Latin America now are supporting the right wing,
right, you know?
And it's like, what is happening when you're becoming older, you know?
Yeah.
And what is happening with these music scenes today? And it's interesting because, I don't know, one of the most significant things about Kurt Cobain in Latin America was his support of Los Os Mutantes. Mutantes, como a key band of the Tropicalia during the 60s. Kurt Cobain was a big fan of Caetano Veloso, Gilberto Gil. And that was como very surprising if you are thinking about Nirvana and Kurt Cobain's idea and the punk. And, but Tropicalia was a super political movement for Latin America. Of course, fighting against the dictatorships in Brazil at that time. I think that I will add in this top list of albums, Os Mutantes. I know that, sorry, Kurt, you didn't pick Os Mutantes, but I'm going to add them there.
I think that, Kurt, like any of us, if you get asked on Tuesday what your 50 favorite albums are, it's different than on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. So I'm sure if somebody in the room or in the van or at the party was like, but Os Mutantes, he'd be like, yes, yes. He's screaming from the corner, ignoring the conversation he's having. Yes, Os, yes, totally. Totally, man. Absolutely. And RIP Rita Lee also while we're here.
Shout out to Os Mutantes. They were one of the best bands I've ever seen live. Mm. And this is like at an advanced age. They played Seattle.
Yes, they played in Seattle like 3 years ago.
Yeah, like a little over 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Two years ago.
Shout out to Freak Out.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for bringing Os Mutantes. Oh my God.
I feel as though we're in a great place to wrap up this discussion, which I could personally do for another couple hours with you all, but we've got to wrap it up sometime, I guess. How do these ideas, this art, these politics resonate in 2024? I mean, we're upon another election year. Lots of distressing things happening all over the world, particularly in Palestine, but also in Congo and a number of other countries. What is the landscape of the music world now? Like, how do we see artists carrying on from this, whether it's direct or whether it's kind of cellular spiritual influence from Kurt Cobain?
I think that when they talk about Nirvana, you know, there's that idea of the year that punk broke, when it went mainstream, but it also kind of broke it. And I think it kind of broke the machinery of rebellion. I think the mainstream society, labels, whatever you want to call it, whatever arm of it, it's really good at co-opting whatever it is and turning it into money. So Rebellion, in this case, it's really good at co-opting that. And I think after Nirvana, we had a whole lot of bands that were kind of empty shells that trying to sound or be like Nirvana, but weren't offering anything of substance, weren't talking about these things. And I feel like we're in this period where music is for the most part, kind of trying to claw its way back to a real political sensibility and efficacy, like being able to do something and affect people. There have been plenty of musicians and people that have been outspoken, of course, since. But I just mean on the biggest scale possible, you know. And I think what we're seeing now is large artists trying to figure out how they can be effectively counteracting the agenda of death and profiteering that controls the world. And I feel like we see it more when we see something like around Palestine. We see artists signing on to letters and standing up in that way, showing that I don't believe in this, or this is what I do believe in, more than I'm necessarily hearing it in the music. So I feel like in a way that kind of that time of Nirvana, and then like Rage kind of immediately after that, shout out Rage Against the Machine, that was kind of the mainstream high point of like revolutionary ideals, I think, in music. And it hasn't been there. It didn't stay there. They turned it into a buck pretty quick. So I think people are trying to figure it out now ever since. It's gone way back underground in terms of people that are really talking about it in music, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you. I feel as though the music world from a money-making standpoint has flattened.
Yeah.
And you see people doing whatever they can to make money as far as the music they create. But as people, they are standing up for the right things. And yeah, it's a very good question of who's going to be that next band that captures the minds and hearts of a wide base of music fans, because everything is so fractured now.
Right.
And when it's going to happen in the face of artists just trying to do what they can to be professional musicians.
There is like a big discussion right now in Latin America about this, because, you know, what Latin music means today, you know, there is a lot of huge scenes for trap, urban, reggaeton, you know, and of course, the mainstream music industry is right now around those music styles. Yeah. So considering the big scene of rock in Latin America during the 80s, during the 90s, of course that we are asking about this new generation. And I've been talking with Karen Kitts from Mexico, and they were telling me that right now they are producing and recording a new album, and they picked Rock for Light of the Bad Brains of the main reference, because they want to bring that music sense into their next album. And they're part of this new scene. We can't see like a big new punk rock, garage rock and hardcore scene across Latin America, but it's always underground.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you were saying that when Nirvana became mainstream, it was like a kind of the beginning of the end, you know, of this revolution, you know, this that the real do it yourself.
Yeah.
And 100%, I have to say. But yes, I think I'm still positive. I think that we have a music scene that is starting to, again, to trying to speak about oppression and this context. But I think that we need more.
Yes.
I can mention legends from South America, such as Eterna Inocencia, Todos Tus Muertos, Masacre Palestina as well. And the new generation, such as Marina Fages, for example, or the indigenous punk rock of Los Cogelones in Ciudad Neza in Mexico, and the current kids in Mexico as well. But we will see. We need more, chicos.
Yes, turn it up.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I've been thinking a lot lately about how the nature of like celebrity and fame and influence has changed in the last few years, or maybe a couple decades even. And like that, there was kind of this perfect storm that was maybe wrapping up when Nirvana broke through. And now it's like, there's so many different types of fame and influence now, and almost dilutes it in a way. But, or you can just find like maybe you're saying, Martin, too, like the fracturedness, like you can kind of find your lane, like, okay, well, I like this sound, but I want this politics, so I'm going to go over here, where there's just so many options now. And so it's hard to like, hard to imagine like another like Nirvana moment.
It is
happening where we all coalesce on an idea, but at the same time, like, it is a great time to go back to the grassroots and to find these underground scenes, like a band, Dead Pioneers out of Colorado, like an indigenous punk band. So good.
Yeah.
And, you know, just bands like that, that were, who are really just getting in to the nitty gritty and getting their hands dirty. And it's so easy to like, also like virtue signal or like, you know, say something that's widely agreeable, but feels maybe you're testing the waters or something, or the mere notion of Taylor Swift making a political statement is setting people ablaze right now. She hasn't even said anything.
Yeah.
Right. So it's such a weird time for this.
And it makes me think of, you know, like Beyonce kind of doing like putting in aesthetics, referencing the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, and people lost their goddamn minds. And that's about the best we can get from the, like the mainstream, the thing that everybody is listening to, because everything is so fractured and so niche. It's like we barely have, I don't think we have the machinery to see such a incredibly incendiary band be the biggest thing in the world anymore. It's really hard to imagine at this point, because everybody's kind of, you know, variously isolated in their different micro scenes and a group of aesthetic markers and everything. It just doesn't work like that anymore. The only huge things like that are Taylor Swift size, are Beyonce size. And if people are imagining them doing something at all critical, people break down, and we'll have huge conversations about it that somehow will break into your world, even if you don't care at all about this person and their art. But yeah, I like to think that there's always the stuff that's bubbling in the underground that's going to become more and more potent as it speaks to people's need to feel a part of something in this world that seems to be burning.
Yeah. Monoculture is not coming back. And I can speak to that because I've been a music journalist a long time, and I couldn't identify a Taylor Swift song walked up to me and slapped me in the face.
Right. There was the one. There was just the one that I can't even think of it now. It was the one.
There's a song called The One. That must be what you mean.
Are we bad music journalists because we don't stand Taylor Swift? I thought that's like a whole school of thought, right? Like you got to be a Swiftie to really be in these journal streets.
There's a full job being a Taylor Swift reporter now.
Right.
I support Swiftie army. I don't want to have problems with them smoke. At all.
No smoke with the Swifties or the Beehive. I ain't coming for y'all. I'm just saying.
Yeah, Swifties, we love you all.
Yes.
Yeah, let's get it. Let's get this paper.
That's a good segue for talking about what's next. March is Women's History Month.
Yeah.
So next month, we will focus on some of the particularly badass women on Kurt's list, starting with PJ Harvey.
Just want to say thanks to Albina Cabrera, Larry Mizell Jr. for being here today for this roundtable. Always so good to have conversations with you all.
Gracias, chicos.
Hell yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And shout out to Roddy Nickpour for engineering and audio production.
Yes, sir.
Isabel Khalili is our podcast manager.
Yes, indeed.
I'm Dusty Henry.
And I'm Martin Douglas. This is the Cobain 50 from Listener Power, KEXP.
Margaret Thatcher.
Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, really spicy takes, which is more than I could say for British food.
I definitely ate some food that tasted like water. out there. I was just like in like bad water.
The British audience is going to hate this.
Oh, man.